May the peace and blessing of Allah be upon you.
And upon you be peace and blessings.
We're looking at the world right now, and, well, it feels like it's in a real state of turmoil, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Chaos, disorder, confusion. You see it everywhere. International relations, domestic issues.
Yeah.
It's pervasive.
And the source material we're discussing today offers a really striking perspective on why that might be.
It really does. It cuts right to the chase.
It argues the fundamental issue isn't really about controlling wickedness, you know, fighting the bad guys out there.
Right. That's often where our focus goes, isn't it?
Exactly. But this source says the core problem, the thing we really need to limit, is self-righteousness.
Self-righteousness. That hits differently.
It does. The idea that believing you're inherently right, maybe looking down on others, that's what often leads to conflict.
Mm-hmm. The source connects that directly to war, even repression, both internationally and, you know, within nations, too.
It's a perspective that really challenges you to think, are we even diagnosing the problem correctly?
Definitely. And that's what this whole discussion is about, exploring the ideas in the source material. It takes a hard look at things.
It talks about failures in leadership, a breakdown in societal values.
Yeah, and it connects these back to, well, struggling to uphold basic virtues needed for good governance and just getting along.
So we want to invite you, the listener, to explore this viewpoint with us.
Mm-hmm.
Is focusing on external evil missing a huge internal piece?
Well, the source jumps right in with its diagnosis. It says our usual tools, rationality, reason, knowledge.
The things we tend to rely on.
Yeah. They're just not enough on their own to fight what it calls a cultural pathology of faithlessness, immorality, and flaunting deviancy.
Wow. Cultural pathology. That's strong language. It implies something deep-seated.
It does. It's saying intellectual solutions alone won't fix it because the roots go deeper, perhaps into moral or spiritual ground.
That's tough for societies like ours that really value intellectual approaches.
And it doesn't stop there. It's quite critical of leadership.
How so?
Well, there's a really blunt statement. It says, many elected politicians today are, and I'm quoting the source here, an affront to the basic standards of honesty, virtue, and citizenship.
An affront. That's more than just criticism, it implies. Like an offense against the very idea of what leadership should be.
Exactly. It suggests a serious gap between the ideals of public service and, well, the reality. Maybe linking back to that self-righteousness idea instead of genuine virtue.
Okay, so after critiquing leadership and our usual methods, where does the source go next?
It brings in a different angle, a divine perspective to understand the bigger picture.
Oh, okay.
It introduces this idea that the coexistence of good and evil isn't a mistake, but, as the source puts it, a divine practice.
A divine practice, so like part of the design.
That seems to be the implication. Maybe for testing, maybe for contrast. The source presents it as inherent.
Interesting. And does it elaborate on that?
It does. And crucially, it includes a warning. It quotes from the Holy Quran, Surah Bani Israel, chapter 17, verse 17.
Now, what's the warning?
It describes what happens when people in a society become rebellious, when they transgress too much. Mm-hmm. It warns that if this becomes widespread, it can lead to, well, a divine judgment and utter destruction.
So it connects societal breakdown directly to moral decay. And its divine consequences.
That's how the source presents it, a potential path, transgression leading to destruction.
Okay, that's a sobering thought.
Yeah.
But does it offer an alternative, a way to avoid that?
Yes, absolutely. It doesn't just leave you with the warning. It points to guidance, quoting another verse, Surah An-Nahl, chapter 16, verse 91.
And what does that verse advise?
It lays out the positive path. It says, Allah enjoins justice, doing good, giving like kindred. So equity, kindness, supporting community.
Okay.
And just as importantly, it forbids indecency, manifest evil, and wrongful transgression. It's framed as divine advice, you know, urging us to choose righteousness over wickedness.
That focus on justice and doing good, It brings us right back to that idea about self-righteousness, doesn't it?
It really does. Because embracing justice and goodness requires looking inward, not just judging others.
So the source calls for self-improvement.
Drastic self-improvement, it says, and fostering responsibility and virtue, not just out there, but right here, within ourselves, within our communities.
And this is where that point about self-righteousness gets really sharp.
Mm-hmm. The source argues the main struggle isn't just good versus evil externally.
What is it then?
It's overcoming the evil in every good and unrighteousness of the righteous.
Whoa. See that again. Evil in every good.
And unrighteousness of the righteous. It's a challenging concept.
It suggests the real battle isn't just out there with the bad people, but inside.
Mm.
even inside those who think they are the good people.
Precisely. Even good actions can have flawed motives, right? Mm-hmm. Pride, self-interest, and unrighteousness of the righteous challenges the idea that just belonging to a group or saying you're pious makes you immune to error or gives you the right to judge.
It's a warning against hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm. Explicitly. The source says the goal is to trounce pious hypocrisy and sanctimony.
Trounce them, not just critique them.
Yeah. It's not against genuine piety, but the fake kind, the kind that wears a mask, lacks substance, and looks down on others. That's seen as a huge barrier to peace.
Because it stops you looking at yourself.
Exactly. And that leads directly to the source's point on equality and justice.
How so?
If you're busy wrestling with your own potential for unrighteousness, it's much harder to be sanctimonious about others. The source argues failure persists until we truly believe, deep down, that all human life is equal and there's justice, dignity, equity, and respect for all.
And that's not just a nice ideal. It's presented as, what, a requirement?
A fundamental requirement for any real lasting change. If we operate even subconsciously like some lives matter less, the systems we build will always be flawed.
That makes sense. Now, the source also touches on something else that feels very relevant today.
Hate. Yes. It makes a rather bleak observation, doesn't it? It says hate is a plentiful resource, endlessly renewable.
That feels uncomfortably true sometimes. So if hate is always available, what's the guidance?
This leads to a really crucial distinction the source makes. Something for you, the listener, to really chew on.
Okay.
It draws a sharp line between having a legal right to do or say something and having a moral right. It suggests that even if the law permits it, morality might demand you don't do it, especially if it fuels hate or causes harm.
So just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Precisely. And the tool for this is courageous restraint.
Courageous restraint. Why courageous?
Because it takes real inner strength, doesn't it, to hold back when you feel you have the right to lash out or speak, especially if you know it would be irresponsible or just add fuel to the fire.
Choosing not to exercise a right for a greater good.
Yes. And this idea of restraint tied to something higher than just law connects to the source's view on peace itself.
How does it define peace?
Not just as the absence of trouble or war. It says true peace requires something more, the presence of God.
So peace isn't just political, it's spiritual, moral.
Fundamentally, yes. The source argues secular laws, while necessary, are insufficient on their own for real, lasting peace and justice.
Why insufficient?
Because you can't just legislate true morality or virtue into existence. It needs something internal, what the source calls personal godliness,
right,
woven into individuals and society. Secular governance provides the structure, but it's incomplete without that inner dimension.
And does it give an example of where secular law falls short?
A very powerful one. The difficulty in holding accountable those who wage illegal wars causing massive civilian deaths. The source points out that secular systems often struggle to deliver justice in these extreme cases. It argues that facing such immense power and disregard for life, only a profound fear of God.
Which it defines how?
Not as terror, but as a deep sense of ultimate responsibility, accountability beyond human courts. Only that can really act as a check against such terrible acts, an internal moral compass linked to God.
That sense of ultimate accountability, it sounds like it connects to the source's view on the purpose of life itself.
Yeah, it does, very strongly. The source suggests knowing God isn't just personal. It involves a fundamental duty to serve humanity.
Serve humanity.
And simultaneously, a constant lifelong obligation for self-reform, self-reflection.
So internal work and external service hand in hand.
Exactly. And it loops back again. Until we genuinely believe in and act on the equality, justice, and dignity of all human life, peace remains out of reach.
It's the very integrated vision.
Yeah.
Given all this, what's the call to action?
It's an urgent plea. And importantly, it's for everyone.
Not just one group.
No. Muslims, non-Muslims, believers, non-believers, everyone,
yeah,
to shed ambivalence, stop hypocrisy. The source uses this stark reminder. The world is too small, our wisdom too limited, and our time here too short to waste any more of it on winning fleeting victories at others' expense.
Stop the destructive behavior, basically.
Yes, and it drives this home with that incredibly sobering quote.
Which one is that?
War does not decide who is right, only who is left.
Oof. That really puts the cost of conflict in perspective.
It does. And this urgency naturally leads to the role of leadership.
How does the source see leadership's role in all this?
As profoundly important. True leaders, it suggests, shape positive narratives, challenge negative trends, not just with policies, but by speaking boldly, embodying virtue themselves, and highlighting the consequences, human and divine, of ignoring these principles.
Does this offer examples of this kind of leadership?
Yes, powerful ones. It points to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as an epitome of this.
How so?
It highlights his commitment to peace, specifically citing the Treaty of Hudaybiyah.
Right, Hudaybiyah.
Where he made significant concessions, gave up perceived rights, his and his followers, for the sake of a longer-term, more fundamental peace. It's presented as this incredible act of courageous restraint and wisdom.
Seeing beyond the immediate.
Exactly. And it also mentions the spiritual root of his leadership, his prayers, his connection, suggesting the outer strength came from that inner depth.
And this legacy continued.
The source says yes, through the rightly guided caliphs in early Islam, and it brings it to the present, mentioning Hazrat Mirza Masroor Ahmad, the current Khalifatul Masih, as someone carrying forward this call to God, prayer, love, and compassion today.
Interesting. It also draws the parallels from a very different context, right?
Abraham Lincoln.
Yes. Fascinatingly, it quotes President Lincoln's 1863 National Fast Day Proclamation during the American Civil War.
What's the connection?
Lincoln linked the awful calamity of the war to potential divine punishment for presumptuous sins. He worried the nation had forgotten God, become too self-sufficient, too proud to pray. The source uses this to show a similar pattern across time and culture. National crisis linked to turning away from humility and spiritual principles.
Seeing a universal dynamic, perhaps. So, given this diagnosis, what's the path forward? What's the condition for hope?
The source is very clear on this. Hope for civilization to emerge from the current strife depends on a fundamental shift.
Which is?
It requires all of us, everyone, everywhere, to revert to God and reform ourselves. Back to the internal again. Reconnecting, reforming.
It's presented as the absolute prerequisite for external peace and a better world. Individual and collective internal change rooted in the divine.
And it seems to tie everything together with a final quote.
Yes, a powerful one from Hazrat Mirza Masroor Ahmad, summarizing that core link.
What does he say?
He's quoted as saying, peace and justice are inseparable. You cannot have one without the other.
Inseparable.
And he adds that disorder simply cannot exist where true justice and fair dealing are genuinely present. It brings it all back to that foundational need for justice, equity, fairness for all, rooted in belief in equal human dignity.
Wow. Okay, this discussion, drawing on the source material, has given us, well, a lot to think about. It definitely pushes beyond the usual analysis.
It really does. It forces that inward look, the dangers of self-righteousness, the need for inner reform, accountability, maybe a spiritual connection.
And it challenges the idea that laws alone are enough, highlighting this need for maybe godliness or a deep moral compass for real peace.
Mm-hmm. Rooted in recognizing everyone's equal dignity and our ultimate responsibility.
So it's a call for everyone, really, whatever your background, to drop the complacency, the hypocrisy, and actively work on virtue and responsibility.
Yeah, in our own lives, our own circles.
As you, our listener, reflect on these ideas from the source, maybe the key question to leave you with is this. If peace and justice truly are inseparable, and if justice relies on believing in the equal dignity of all, and if our own self-righteousness is a major block,
then what does courageous restraint actually look like for you? How do you apply it to your own judgments, your own potential self-righteousness in your daily life?